So before my accident, I was living a really good, pretty good story. I had a husband, three kids, a real estate license. I was living in the mountains of Montana. And I was also the ministry, women's ministry leader for the state of Montana. So I was busy. The day before my accident, I was actually playing double pianos for camp meeting with both hands instead of the six hands that I play with now. So that morning, I woke up, and I went for a five-mile jog. I showered and had my devotional time. And in my devotional time that morning, in my journal, I wrote, God, what do you want me to do with my life? What is this this time of my life? Do you have some plans for me? I will do whatever you want me to do. And I really didn't expect that later that same day, this would happen. For those of you who were here last week, you heard the story of what happened here. I really did not expect this.
Trauma is disorienting. And Becky, you could probably speak a little bit to the disorientation of being in a vehicle that's tumbling down the borrow pit at 70 miles an hour.
Yes, I didn't know where I was, literally. I sitting in the wreckage of my Jeep, unable to move from the neck down, I didn't know where my story was going. I knew that I wasn't going to have function, and I felt, I couldn't feel anything from the neck down. I was afraid I was going to die, and I was also afraid I wouldn't die. I don't know if any of you have ever felt that feeling, but
very disorienting. You go through an experience like that, it's very disorienting. And, the experience of disorientation has different perspectives to it, too. You know, there's Becky's perspective of being in the vehicle, tumbling, and getting beaten by the brute force of the accident. And then there's the experience that I had watching it happen in the rearview mirror of my car. I watched Becky's car swerve, and I said to my son Paul, who was with me in the car, I said, "What's Mom doing?" You know, I thought she was turning off the road or something. And I saw her car kind of overcorrect and get caught in one of those nasty, deadly overcorrecting, skidding back and forth kinds of things on the highway before her vehicle slid off the road. And my first feeling was, as she went off the road, it's like, oh, it's not so bad. You know, she just kind of gently, it looked like to me, just kind of gently went off the road. And then her car flipped. And if you've studied physics much, you know that there's different kinds of energy in a moving object. There's the rotational energy of the wheels as you're going down the road. And just, you know, imagine at 70 miles an hour, imagine how fast those wheels are rotating, right? When you slide off the road and broadside and your whole vehicle starts to roll, your vehicle has to roll as fast as those wheels were rolling by themselves.
Probably about 80 miles an hour.
And so I watched, for the record, it was 70.
Okay.
I watched.
Because I was following you.
And it seemed, ooh.
Sorry.
Let's have the benediction. She's so good. I saw the car slide off the road and I thought, oh, not so bad. She just pulled off the road. And then I saw it flip. And then I saw the flipping accelerate as the vehicle's rotational energy caught up with its energy going down the highway at 70 miles an hour. And it literally flipped and then just accelerated. And I watched in my rearview mirror the most violent car accident I had ever seen. And I watch movies that have violent car accidents in them. Talk about disorientation. If you've ever been in an experience like that, and I know many of you have been in those kinds of terrifying, horrifying experiences, your hearing checks out. Your ears start to ring. The whole world becomes surreal, and you can't even articulate intelligible words. I was screaming, crying out in just these distorted, grotesque vocal expressions that didn't even make any sense. In fact, my daughter, who was, about
7 years
old at the time, told me later, she said, "You sounded like Elmer Fudd." Well, I don't know what that means, but I think it was a seven-year-old's way of trying to say you were unintelligible. I couldn't understand anything that was coming out of your mouth. Watching your family tumble down the highway, down the borrow pit, accelerating at that kind of speed, believing that they are all dead, is disorienting. You don't know who you are anymore. You don't know what's going to become of your life. Everything is different and everything has changed. And then we found ourselves in this desolation of Montana. If you look at this picture and you see where the car is on the road right there, that's where Becky came skidding off and tumbling from those bushes next to that car almost all the way to the edge of this hill where we're standing. And we're out in the middle of nowhere, Montana. There's no cell signal. You look around and there's a few farm buildings and things like that, but there's no house to run up to. And I checked on Becky, I checked on Spencer, and they were alive, they were breathing. Becky wasn't moving from the neck down, she was struggling to breathe. And I just ran back up to the highway, and I started waving people down. You know, you're going this way, go to a farmhouse and call 911. You're going that way, go to a farmhouse and call 911. It was the only thing I could do. Totally lost, totally disoriented. Where in the world are we? And we had driven through this valley many times, but it's hard to be oriented when you're in desolation. And that's the experience that we have. This feeling of being desolate. And add to that the things that are rolling through your mind. Is my wife going to die? You go from my wife and my son are dead until you get up to the car and you find out they're alive. And then you have the next one, and that is my son, I think he's okay, but I think Becky might be dying. And we're out in the middle of nowhere, Montana. And when in the world is that ambulance going to get here? We waited for over an hour before the ambulance showed up. Thing is, we can all relate, because trauma is disorienting. Like a rolling vehicle, this planet is revolving at 1,000 miles an hour, believe it or not. We are living a reality of tumbling through the borrow pit, and we've had that experience, and we've experienced in the process political upheaval, social division, the terror of deadly pandemic. We've had all of that kind of experience in the last few years collectively in the same tumbling vehicle.
And we've all tried to figure out, as Montanans moving to the city, I just have to say that COVID brought a lot of different thoughts to our mind. Do we bug in? Do we bug out? What are we supposed to do? You know, we have 3 million people and everyone's sick, and we have these germs and it's deadly and it's really stressful. And so we did something during COVID that some of you who saw us during church campouts might recognize, and that is, first we bought a truck and a camper. And we thought that was a good thing.
We were thinking bug out.
Yeah, we were thinking bug out. And then we thought, well, this is kind of small. Maybe we should buy a trailer instead. So we bought a trailer, and then we decided, maybe we like the trailer, we're going to sell the truck camper. And we sold the truck camper. And then we decided,
got a different truck.
Yeah, we got a different truck. And then we decided that we're going to, the trailer's too big, we can just go back to a camper. Anyway,
we bought a camper.
So we bought and sold. And, you know, I think it was really disorienting for a lot of people. A lot of people did remodels on their house. They ripped out their grass and put in something new. We just had all kinds of upheaval during COVID. And for Barry and I, that was trying to decide how we wanted to camp, evidently. There was other things, too.
We learned how we want to camp.
Yeah. Right? We now have a truck and a camper, and it's fine.
Becky actually missed one other trailer.
Oh,
trailer we bought during that time of disorientation and upheaval. I hope we're not the only ones that just kind of cracked during COVID. Did anybody else kind of find themselves not knowing, where am I going to live? You know, what's happening? Okay, good. I see some heads nodding. I'm glad we're not alone on that. It was a disorienting time. So Jesus speaks to this.
Yes, and he speaks to the human predicament of disorientation. He says, when you see a cloud rising in the west, you say at once, a shower is coming, and so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you say, there will be scorching heat, and it happens. You hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time?
So we're great weather forecasters, right? We can see, oh no, it's going to rain. I better bring something in from outside and have that kind of thing. But Jesus says we struggle at knowing where we are in time. What's our timing? And Jesus is speaking, I think, to something very important, and that is this bigger picture of time is helpful for us when we go through difficult times and when we go through this kind of disorientation.
So trauma really changed Daniel's story immensely. Before Babylon, Daniel was smart, and he was young and smart and strong, and he was healthy, and he had his whole world ahead of him. I'm sure that he dreamed of having a wife and kids and having a great job. The world was his to have, but virtually overnight, everything changed. Daniel and his friends experienced some changes to their story. New place, new power, new structure, new names, new religion. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego.
So you notice their names are changed, and their names are changed to from names. Daniel is the name that has to do with Daniel's God. It has to do with his reality and his world. And their names are changed to Babylonian names, reflecting faith in Babylonian gods. There's this pressure, there's this effort to change everything about them. But that's not the part of the verse that I find most disturbing. This highlighted part is the part that I find most disturbing. Daniel has a geographical change. He has a loss of his city, a loss of his temple, a loss of all other kinds of things. But if you are under the supervision of the chief of eunuchs, what are you? Daniel's lost everything. He's lost everything. And you can just imagine the experience that he has. And yet the thing that's remarkable about Daniel is, despite what he's gone through, despite what he has experienced, he's incredibly resilient. He seems to know how to thrive and not just survive, but to thrive in a world that has been turned upside down for him. In Daniel 2, we find Daniel's worldview, and we find a competing worldview. We find two worlds that are kind of in conflict. And the first worldview has to do with this dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. He has this dream, and he sees the dream and experiences the dream, but he needs an interpretation for the dream. But he's got a problem, and that is that all the wise men in Babylon, if you tell them a dream, they're going to figure out an interpretation for it, right? I had this dream. I saw this image, head of gold, chest and arms of silver, waist of bronze, legs of iron. The wise men of Babylon, they're going to make something out of that. You know, they're going to give you a fortune cookie of some kind or another based upon that. And so Nebuchadnezzar says, you've got to not only interpret the dream, but you've got to tell me what I dreamed too. If you really have a connection, that's what I want. And of course, as you know, there's only one man in Babylon with the connection. And so we find this story here having to do with Daniel.
Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in the vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and he sets up kings.
So with the Daniel story, we know that we're having this conversation about worldview. We're having a conversation about narratives. And I want you to notice that immediately we get this hint into Daniel's narrative and Daniel's story, Daniel's worldview. And because when Daniel receives the vision, he praises God. He not only praises God that the vision has been revealed to him, because some of these wise men's necks were on the chopping block if they couldn't come up with the dream that the king dreamed, but he's also excited because God removes kings and he sets up kings. See, in Daniel's worldview, that's really great news. If you've lost your city and you've lost your temple and you've lost your family and you've lost your ability to even reproduce and make a family, it's really good news to know that God is in charge. And God's going to deal with your biggest problems. And Daniel had to face his biggest problems every day because Nebuchadnezzar was Daniel's biggest problem. And he worked for the guy. So, serious dynamic going on here. But Nebuchadnezzar has a worldview too. And we see his worldview reflected in this verse. I want you to notice something about this verse. Are you able to make known to me the dream? And Daniel's reply is, no. No, I'm not able to make known to you the dream. Which you kind of wonder if at some point there Nebuchadnezzar is like, why are you wasting my time here in, you know, before my throne? You know, why are you wasting my time? But Daniel shares a worldview with the king that the king does not share. The king believes that certain people just have really great talent and they can do really great things. And Daniel says, no, there's nobody that can do that, but there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Here we see Daniel's worldview, his narrative. It's not just a narrative, it's what we call a meta-narrative. It's a big worldview. And Daniel reveals that to him. And in the process, we see that we have two different worldviews. Notice how Daniel explains this.
Go ahead, Dan. Reaffirms this view as he shares the dream with the king. To you, O king, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be after this. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be.
You see Daniel's worldview here again. He's saying the one who reveals mysteries. He believes that there is this God that can somehow look at time and see it from a perspective that's different than ours. God can somehow see this whole timeline, whereas we only live in time in the present.
But as for me, Daniel says, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your mind. So Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar that the only reason this mystery has been revealed is so that the king may know the interpreter and that he may know the thoughts of his mind. Wow, God really cares about this pagan king. He's trying to reach this pagan king through Daniel.
And God is also helping King Nebuchadnezzar see his worldview in contrast to this big story. You'll be able to know and understand not only the interpretation of the dream, but you'll also be able to understand the thoughts of your own mind. I love how God works with this king. God wants to win Nebuchadnezzar. Notice Daniel's perspective on the dream, though. When Daniel sees the dream, when he has the dream, and he tries to describe the dream, he says, the appearance of it was frightening. And I don't know about you, but if you were to see an image, I showed the image on the screen a few minutes ago, head of gold, chest and arms of silver, waist of bronze, legs of iron. Is that frightening? Is that a scary picture? Mm-mm. I don't think I had to warn parents to put their hands over their children's eyes when I showed that picture. It's not really that scary of a picture, so why is it scary to Daniel? In fact, if Nebuchadnezzar were to look at that picture, he would say, wow, look at all that gold. Look at all that silver. Look at all that bronze. Look at all that iron. To a king, that's wealth. That's actual intrinsic wealth. And it's the ability to purchase and build and make an army. It's a beautiful picture. That same picture to Daniel is frightening. Two different worldviews, two different ways of seeing the same things. You see this image that represents the kingdoms of this world, and they're scary. And then suddenly Nebuchadnezzar, as he's looking at this image, and he sees this head of gold and chest and arms of silver and waist of bronze, and he sees all these things, this wealth and this military power that he can imagine. Now the story gets frightening to Nebuchadnezzar. He sees this stone cut out without human hands. You know, just imagine the sequence of value. Gold, silver, bronze, iron, iron and clay. What's next? Stone. Stone is next, right? I mean, you got to admit, right? If you turn a stone into gold, you'd be pretty rich, because there's a lot of stones out there. It's very common. It has no value whatsoever. And what happens to Nebuchadnezzar's paradigm, what happens to his worldview, is something that he perceives as having zero value comes in and destroys all of the things that he considers to be of great value. A new idea, a new way of looking at things, a new way of valuing things has come crashing into his world and has absolutely demolished his worldview. It's been shattered. It's crumbled to the dust. And then not only is it crumbled to the dust, but the wind comes and the wind just blows it all away like it's chaff on the threshing floor. Imagine what goes through the thoughts of Nebuchadnezzar's mind as he sees all that gold just blow away. All that silver just blow away. All that bronze just blow away. All the iron, all the clay just disappearing before his eyes. That's the experience and the picture that he has. And then Daniel turns around to Nebuchadnezzar and he says these powerful words to him that share a new perspective to this king that the king had probably never really seen and realized before. He turns and he addresses the king and he says this.
You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, the glory, and into whose hands he is given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you rule over all. You are the head of gold.
So notice that Daniel comes to Nebuchadnezzar and he says, you saw that image, you saw the value, you saw the beauty, you saw the glory. God gave that to you. There's this God of heaven. He gave you your kingdom. He gave you your power. He gave you your might. He gave you your glory. He's given you everything. Children, beasts, birds. He is making you rule over these things. It's a shattering worldview perspective for him.
But what is Daniel hearing when he hears this from Daniel? He is hearing, you, O king, oh, the king of kings, blah, 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 yada, 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 wonk, 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 gabber, glabber, glabber, glabber. You are the head of gold.
So it's kind of like Nebuchadnezzar is Charlie Brown in the classroom, right? Mm-hmm. You ever watch the Charlie Brown movies where the teacher talks and all Charlie Brown hears is wonk, 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 wonk. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't hear anything except you're the head of gold. That's it. Why? Because Nebuchadnezzar's worldview is all about himself. He has a narrative. He has a story. But the narrative and the story he has is his personal narrative and his personal story. Right. Now we look at Nebuchadnezzar's response, though. What does he end up doing?
Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, truly, your God is God of gods, Lord of kings, and the revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery.
And you notice the emphasis that Daniel puts on this. The emphasis he puts on it is you, Daniel. You know, he falls on his face and he worships Daniel. He offers incense to him, a sacrifice of incense. And it's as if Daniel possesses the God instead of the God possesses Daniel. Do you see that? Your God. You must have good gods because you are really great. You are really powerful. Nebuchadnezzar's paradigm is upside down. And he even thinks that Daniel is able to reveal the mystery, even though Daniel says, I can't reveal the mystery, only God can. Nebuchadnezzar's next move, then, is to promote Daniel. And you notice what he does here. He gives him high honors. He gives him great gifts. He makes him ruler. He makes him chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. But notice what Daniel does with it.
Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court.
So Daniel gives away his job. He's given power, he's given authority, and he takes it all and he just passes it on to his friends. Gives it to his friends. And Daniel remains in the king's court. A eunuch, under the chief of eunuchs, just serving in the court. That's what he does with the power that's given to him. Why? Because he knows it's not his power. It's not his power to have. It's not his power to hold. And the thing I think we learn from this is that when trauma strikes, there are two possible places that we can go to for help. And one of those places is to human wisdom and kingdoms and powers. And the other one is to, that's a typo. I corrected that. It didn't get corrected on my computer. To God's wisdom and God's kingdom and God's power. It's two different paradigms. The devil doesn't want you to know the contrast, so he just kept my slide the same. That's the only option he wants you to choose, okay? You see that? And what we discover here as we explore this is this contrast between narrative and meta-narrative and worldview. And I'm going to try to go over this quickly because I realize I don't have as much time as I thought I had. But we'll take a look at this. So we're going to describe these in detail here. A narrative is a story. A narrative is a small story. Every one of us have our narrative. Every one of us have our small story. Becky was in a car accident in 2005, right? And she recovered and she rehabbed. And that's her story. That's her story. It's her narrative. But a meta-narrative is bigger than that. A meta-narrative is an overarching story that not only is a story that you or I might believe or know, but it's an overarching story that includes all of our other stories. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar experiences when he has this vision. He experiences a meta-narrative. Now, the fascinating thing about it is, from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective in time, when he sees this image and he's told that the gold represents Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, he's the head of gold. After him is going to come another kingdom that's like the silver kingdom, this Medo-Persian empire. And after that is going to come another kingdom, the empire of Greece, Alexander the Great. And after that is going to come Rome. Those kingdoms aren't named to Nebuchadnezzar. He just knows that his kingdom will be succeeded by another kingdom, will be succeeded by another kingdom. And this is Daniel's meta-narrative. Daniel's big worldview is that kingdoms keep following one another, and yet even as all of this goes on planet Earth, God is truly in control. God is ultimately in control. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't believe that. He believes, I'm the head of gold. That's it. I'm in control. I have the power. I rule over the kingdoms of men. And the thing that's missing is that Nebuchadnezzar doesn't see that big, large worldview. Now, what's really fascinating to me about this is we are on the other side of history from Nebuchadnezzar. We not only know that Daniel's meta-narrative was revealed to Nebuchadnezzar, that Nebuchadnezzar was able to see this big worldview, we not only know that, but we also know that Daniel's meta-narrative was true. Nebuchadnezzar's empire was conquered by a twofold, two-armed empire, Medo-Persia. That was followed by Alexander the Great, the Greek Empire. That was followed by Caesar Augustus, the Roman Empire. It's a true meta-narrative. And it's really important to recognize that. And that big picture ends up shaping our worldview. It's not just prophecy anymore. It's history now. Daniel 2 is history. And this is where worldview comes in. And when we go through all kinds of trauma and we go through all this painful experience, one of the things that we realize and that we discover is that worldview matters. If you go through a global pandemic and you go through political unrest and you live in a city of 3 million people and you know that there's all of this pain and this suffering and sensitivity to injustice and everything else that's going on, there are these big problems. You know, there's political unrest, there's pandemic, there's climate change fears, there's all kinds of meta problems. And we think that somehow we can find some kind of solution. We've got to find a meta solution to our meta problems. And so we need a meta narrative. And part of what I'm suggesting today is that we already have one. We already have a large worldview. We live in this day and age where postmodernism dispensed with the meta narrative. There is no overarching story. There is no absolute truth. Everybody has their own individual personal truth, and you just have your truth, and I'll have my truth. You live your story, I'll live my story. But then when we go through disaster, when we go through a pandemic, when we go through the political upheaval that we're going through in our lives, it doesn't work anymore for us to be individualized. It doesn't work anymore for you to have your individual story and me to have my individual story, because if the whole world is falling apart, the climate is changing and the world is falling apart, our individual stories can end up making the world worse instead of better. If there's a pandemic and you're living your truth and I'm living my truth and everybody's living their individual truths, we can end up shattered and fragmented too, and we did. But if there's a meta-narrative that was told to a king long before it ever happened, and that was proven by history to be true, there's an overarching story that, if believed and embraced and received, pulls us all together. And it's not until we're all pulled together that our individual stories and our meta-narrative can work together. See, every story starts with once upon a time, right? Every story has to do with individual experiences and individual stories, and that's all a very individual thing. But when we have our meta-narrative straight, when we have that little stone inside of our head that orients us in the world in which we live and tells us what is up and what is down and what is right and what is left, and we have that orientation, then we can live our story the way God intended it to be lived. It's that big worldview picture, and I think Becky has a story to tell us about how her meta-narrative and her personal story came together.
So just after my accident, they took me to Butte, Montana, and I was on a ventilator for about 10 days. This is not me on the ventilator. Barry didn't take any pictures of that time, but it illustrates a little bit about where I was at this time. I have very few memories on the ventilator. They kept me in a drug-induced coma, and once I started to come out of it, I was very uncomfortable. So I'm going to go back a little bit and just tell you a little bit about what was happening before this. I was women's ministry leader for the conference, and we had just finished doing, we would travel to different churches, and it was the conference leaders, and it was the special choir from Mount Ellis, which my son was in at the time. And every single time that we would do it, we did it like 6 different times. Every single time they sang for the congregations, they would sing one song, and that one song would make me cry, and I would sit in the audience and cry, and my 17-year-old son was probably rolling his eyes because he was singing in the choir, seeing me, my mom's crying again. But that song just really deeply touched me. So now I'm several months later, and I'm laying in ICU on a ventilator in a drug-induced coma. And I woke up, and I want to say, I think probably almost all the time I had someone with me, but for some reason, at this time, I didn't. And I don't know if any of you know what it feels like to be claustrophobic in your own body when you can't move. It was very terrifying for me. I would come out of the medication, and I just, at this one time, I just felt like claustrophobic. I wanted to move. I couldn't move. I was hurting really bad. I And I had two collapsed lungs. All my ribs were broken. I just had surgery on my neck, and it was really painful, and I couldn't hit a button and have somebody come. And the words to that song just came to my mind. And I started singing in my mind, of course, not talking because I couldn't talk. But I started singing, "Precious Lord, take my hand. Sorry. Lead me on, help me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on to the light. Precious Lord, take my hand." And as I sang the words to that song in my mind, which I have no doubt that God had put in my heart for a reason, I felt a hand on my hand. I couldn't see anybody there, but I felt a hand on my hand. And I knew that my story was forever changed. I wouldn't be the same, but it was going to be okay. Everything was going to be okay. God took over my broken story, and He will take care of all of our broken stories.
He takes our stories, and He turns them into His story, and the rest is history. I love the verse that Eugene Peterson has paraphrased here. You won't hear me quote the Message Bible very often in my sermons, but I love this paraphrase.
All this energy issues from Christ. God raised Him from death and set Him on a throne in deep heaven, in charge of running the universe. Everything from galaxies to governments, no name and no power exempt from His rule, not even Nebuchadnezzar. And not just for the time being, but forever. He is in charge of it all. He has the final word on everything. At the center of all this, Christ rules the church. The church, you see, is not peripheral to the world. The world is peripheral to the church. The church is Christ's body, in which He speaks and acts, by which He fills everything with His presence.
You know, I realize that when somebody hears a message like this, one of the thoughts that's probably going to pop into their heads is, this world? Really? Jesus is in charge of this world? Is this all the better He can do? We think we're pretty wise when we ask that question, you know. It is an interesting contrast, and typically we tend to also say, if I were in charge of the world, I'd do a lot better job than Jesus is doing. But it's important to remember, Daniel could have asked that question too. God's really in control. He's really in charge. He sets up kings and takes down kings. He set up this king that robbed me of my city and robbed me of my temple and robbed me of my family and robbed me of my ability to reproduce and to have a family of my own. Really, that's the God that's in control? Daniel could have asked that question, but when we read the story of Daniel, we find somebody who lives in confident assurance of that God who is in control, even when everything seems to be out of control. When you hear Becky's story, and believe me, I've had my moments. You'll hear about those here in the future in this series. You have those moments where you say, really, God's in control? He's really in control? Somebody can stand here and can say, yep, He is. And it's good. It's good.